Thank you very much, Christopher. First thing I think is to ask you whether you can hear me all right. Everybody here? Excellent. Well, Christopher's given out what the topic is about. I guess if you were to break it down, what we're really trying to focus on tonight is something along the lines of the nature and place of Islam in the contemporary world. Because there's probably not a bulletin that goes by that doesn't mention something to do with Islam, something to do with Muslims, whether it's in this country or in another part of the world. So we're going to look at it. How much in depth, I'm not sure. That's for you to judge. Obviously, we have a limited time, and it is an enormous subject, and we can only hope to cover really a very little bit of the dimensions of it. I'd like to begin, if I may, with a rather juicy quote. This comes from somebody who's recognized as a world authority on Islam. So it's not my idea, and I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with what he says, but I think it's a good way of introducing it to you. His name is John Esposito, and he wrote a book like so many people have written after the tragedy in New York and Washington of the 11th of September, a book called Unholy War, Terror in the Name of Islam. And he says this: the 21st century will be dominated by the global encounter of two major and rapidly growing world religions, Christianity and Islam, and by the forces of globalization that will strain relations between the West and the rest. So there you have it in a nutshell, if you like, the whole title: Islam, the West, and Christian faith. You have an outline, and I hope you'll be able to follow. And it's an attempt so that you don't get lost as we go on into the topic. Soon after the demise of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, some were identifying a new potential threat to Western culture, values, and way of life. In 1993, that's 2 years after the overthrow of communism in Russia, an obscure British academic teaching political science in the USA, whose name is Samuel Huntington, wrote an article which was later expanded into a book, in which he promoted the idea that the real cause of friction between different parts of the world was not to be found so much in political ideologies, as had been the case in terms of the Cold War, but rather in cultures. And he emphasized, I don't know that in any sense he's a Christian believer, but he emphasized that the most crucial and formative aspect of a culture was religious belief and practice. Although he identified seven different culture types, which he referred to as civilizations, a large proportion of the book is devoted to a consideration of only one of them, namely that of Islam. Now, his concern was to analyze the ways in which contrasting civilizations could engender serious hostilities, leading possibly to violent confrontation, and to suggest the means by which such civilizations could learn to live in peaceful coexistence. It's not my intention to enter the debate that Huntington's thesis has produced, but rather I will attempt to address some of the religious, cultural, political, and social issues that are implicit in the question about conflict, with a question mark, of course, and offer a Christian reflection on the current situation. I hope this will stimulate amongst us a good discussion. You will contribute your ideas and your concerns so that all of us may understand better this aspect of the world we live in. It's not this one. Is it booming? Oh. What can we do about the boom? Could you? Thank you, Christopher. First of all, then, let us look at the terms in use. At the outset, we should note that the two designations, Islam and the West, are not exactly equivalent terms. Islam clearly is a religion that combines belief in God with social structures and the exercise of political power, and we'll see a bit more of that later on. Some see it as a faith-based ideology, or at least different aspects of Islam. The West represents a system of beliefs and values about what is true and good that, by and large, wishes to exclude God from public life, at least, substituting other beliefs as a basis for justifying particular social structures, moral values, and the exercise of political power. However, both adhere to implicit or explicit views of what it means to be human, although they appear almost impossible to reconcile. Let us look at the present antagonisms between the West and Islam. A number of historical, cultural, and political factors inform present relationships between the two groups, and I will try to present them from the respective viewpoint of each side. And we'll look first at Islamic opposition to the West. So I begin by trying to summarize some of the main reasons why Muslims see the West as a threat. Four different points here, very briefly. First is the West's defense of what might be called revisionist Islamic states. The West is accused by militant Islamic groups of supporting governments which resist, in their view, becoming true Islamic nations. Thus, for example, the West backed Iraq prior to 1991 in its war against the revolutionary Islamic State of Iran. It helped militia groups in Afghanistan defeat the Taliban. It is in league with governments in countries such as Egypt, Algeria, Jordan, and Pakistan in their struggle to defeat revolutionary Islamic groups within their societies. Saudi Arabia, seen by Osama bin Laden as the greatest traitor to Islam, has allowed foreign troops to be stationed on the soil of the nation that guards the most holy site of the faith, namely Mecca. There is a general view that the West believes it has the right to consider the Middle East as a legitimate part of its sphere of interest, or, to put it more crudely, to maintain access to oil at any cost. So, in order to achieve this end, it will back so-called moderate regimes, which are prepared to defend its interests in the region. Secondly, the state of Israel and the Palestinian question. There is a tremendous sense of injustice on the part of Arabs in particular at the creation of a separate state for Jewish people. Some believe that Zionism is an assault on the territorial integrity of the Muslim Arab people. They are outraged that Israel is supported by the USA in its refusal to observe a number of United Nations resolutions concerning the occupation of Palestinian territory. The veto comes across every time. This is in contrast, they say, to the hypocrisy of the USA in enforcing United Nations resolutions against Iraq by force, or even invading Iraq without the sanction of the Security Council. The refusal of the USA to bring sufficient pressure to bear on Israel to exchange territory for security through the creation of a viable Palestinian state is seen by some as a Zionist plot to keep Arabs divided and weak. Thirdly, the threat of secularism and pluralism. There is a general fear abroad among Islamic communities that the West is trying to undermine Islamic culture by introducing those Western values that are tied to individual freedoms, human rights, the privatization of faith, and a liberalization of moral practices, and also the gratuitous, as they see it, critique of Muslim sacred symbols, such as the Quran, in the case of Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses, or Muhammad, as in the case of the Danish cartoons, or even Jesus, who is highly revered by Muslims, as in the case of the film The Last Temptation of Christ. And fourthly and finally, the domestication of Islam. It has been noted, especially since 9/11, that Western scholars and governments have been energetically engaged in trying to define what might be called ideal Islam. And they have hit upon the notion, and you can hear it over and over again in commentaries on the subject, of moderate Islam, in stark contrast to radical, fundamentalist, or extremist versions. This attempt from outside the faith to produce a sanitized version of Islam is interpreted by some as the desire to redefine Islam so that it fits into the typical Western understanding of what it means to be a liberal, secular, and pluralist society. Now, this is interpreted as yet another example of the desire to control the threat of a new Islamic invasion of Europe. Western governments and opinion formers are locked into a struggle to isolate and discredit radical Islam by co-opting another form of Islam for consumption in a secular society. We'll come back to the question of the secular towards the end. Secondly, on the other side of the equation, as it were, what about the Western fear of Islam? Well, again, I have four brief points. The history of Europe is the first. Islam is the only external civilization that has threatened the territorial integrity of Europe. From the 7th to the 15th centuries, Europe was encircled by Islamic empires, and for much of this time, significant parts of the European continent were ruled by Islamic powers. Only in the 16th century did European nations gain control of the seas and thereby manage to outflank the Islamic encirclement. European peoples are also well aware of the persistent Islamic claim that it has a mission to institute its civilization in all parts of the globe. There is therefore a long residual historical consciousness of the peril of being subjected to Islamic dominion as an alien force. And this has led to the fear, whether it is correct or not, that the present Muslim populations of Europe are acting as a kind of fifth column. Their presence is viewed with suspicion because it is assumed that their primary allegiance is not to their adopted country, but to the wider universal Muslim people. Secondly, the refusal of liberal democracy. Islam is perceived as having a perennial yearning for the implementation of a theocratic state. One example of this desire can be seen in its approach to law and punishment. Western nations currently found their legal systems on the concept of natural justice, defined more or less in terms of the rule of law based on an implicit contract between all citizens that acknowledge their absolute equality and their reciprocal rights and duties. But the Islamic ideal is quite different. It is to follow the alleged dictates of revelation, as those are contained in the Quran, in the Sunnah, or the way of Muhammad, and the Hadith, which are the traditions about Muhammad. In the Western mind, this equates with the imposition of the regulations of Sharia law, the codified legal system developed during the first three centuries after the death of Muhammad. Now, in particular, I think, the West is dismayed by the lack of guarantees protecting human rights in Muslim societies, such as the freedom to change religious allegiance, which, if you are interested, is Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Civil liberties in the West began in the non-conformist conscience. So the freedom of citizens to change their beliefs is therefore a principal human right and one of the touchstones of an open society. Thirdly, a pre-critical religion. Islam is seen as a religion that does not allow the free play of critical historical analysis of its early history, of its foundation documents, and subsequent traditions. Traditionally minded Muslims refuse, for example, to acknowledge any kind of historical relationship between the life of Muhammad and the various surahs or chapters of the Quran. You may or may not know that these, say, the chapters of the Quran are presented not in chronological order, but according to their length, beginning with the longest and going through to the shortest at the end. Non-Muslim scholars of the Quran are convinced that a much greater depth of meaning would be extracted from the text were it to be related to the life and circumstances of Muhammad's leadership of his followers in Mecca and Medina. And a little later we will see, I hope, the relevance of this point. Also, Islamic apologetics is accused of a refusal to take seriously both Jewish and Christian self-understandings. And in the latter case, in the case of Christian faith, of the ludicrous attempts to demonstrate that somehow the New Testament has been corrupted. The question of the origin of the sayings in the Quran, where these quite clearly contradict similar accounts in the Bible, is not properly addressed. I came across another one only this evening as I was rereading a few of the texts, not perhaps terribly important, but just to give you an illustration. You will remember that in the Old Testament, Gideon was told by God to reduce his army. And the way that he reduced his army was by getting them to drink. And those who drank were the ones who didn't fight, and those who did not drink were the ones who he carried on and took with him into the battle. In the Quran, it's not Gideon, but it's Saul who is made to do the same thing. You may say, well, just not terribly important. But there are a number of occasions where the Quran rewrites or misunderstands or has a mistake about the biblical account. Islamic tradition has tended to assert dogmatically the unity of the prophetic message prior to the final revelation from God. That is to say, the Quran is seen as the final revelation, and it sums up, it is a summary of all previous revelations given to all previous prophets, including Jesus amongst the prophets. Therefore, there cannot be any contradiction between them. If there appears to be a contradiction, if there appears to be any discrepancy, it has to be resolved by appeal to the principle of correction. What comes later corrects that which has gone before. So by definition, where there are irreconcilable differences between the Bible and the Quran, the former has to be wrong. Finally, a resistance to integration. It is alleged that Muslims form the group of immigrants that find it most difficult to come to terms with the cultural traditions and conventions of the host countries. The most notable examples of this in the recent or fairly recent past might be the cases of book burning, if your mind casts you back to that, protests against freedom of expression, as in the case, I know it's controversial, it'll be interesting perhaps to see your views on this, the case of a law against incitement to religious hatred, and the position of women in society, exemplified by head covering as a sign of submission. This leads to the view that Islam is by nature anti-progressive, arrogant, and disrespectful of the beliefs and practices of the majority in a society. Practitioners of some other religions, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, for example, seem to integrate more readily. So much for the antagonisms. Of course, a lot more could be said. And I want to move on to a heading which I call Manifest Destinies. One of the most intriguing aspects of present tensions between Islam and the West is that both Islam and specifically the USA possess a strong underlying belief in the manifest destiny which God directly or Providence indirectly has conferred upon each of them. Let us examine each in turn. First of all, the United States of America. Within the US, if there's anybody from the United States here, perhaps you will put me right if I go wrong. Within the US consciousness, there is a strong semi-religious belief that it is a nation that has been richly blessed. Although shorn of religious associations in many cases, Thanksgiving Day, celebrated last week on the fourth Thursday in November, is a reminder of the privileges inherited by those fortunate to be citizens of the US. However, this sense of being favored is taken not merely as a piece of good fortune, but as a call to pass on the blessings to the rest of the world. Our blessings include, in this view, economic prosperity, technological achievement, equality of opportunity, a constitution that emphasizes justice, fairness, equality under the law, and the successful distribution of power in a stable democracy. It also holds out the example of generous hospitality to refugees and the poor from all over the world, and the integration of many cultures into one nation. The US originated in the search for freedom of religious conscience and practice, and independence from colonial administration. It believes, therefore, that it has a good reason to see its social order as progressive and enlightened, particularly in the respect given to the rights and freedoms of the individual, and therefore in the vanguard of a better world order. It is natural, therefore, that it should wish to share its benefits with all other peoples, believing that they too could be successful by adopting its values and institutions. It accepts some responsibility, therefore, for heading the struggle against all enemies of its vision of the good life, be they atheists, in the case of the communists, or ultra-theists, in the case of radical Muslims. The vision for all nations is of a modern, liberal, democratic, prosperous society based on the creation of wealth through economic enterprise and on the integrity of the law. What about Islam? Well, a central part of the historical consciousness of Muslims is the belief that if God's people remain obedient and faithful to the prophetic message delivered by Muhammad, God will grant them success. And some people call this not so much manifest destiny as manifest success, particularly in the Sunni version of Islam. This is based on the conviction that the Quran is the last and final revelation and Muhammad is the seal of the prophets. Islam sees itself as the one message from God which sums up all previous revelations, and in this one revelation God gives precise instructions about how to live in his world. Now the world is divided, according to classic Islam, into Dar al-Islam, which is variously translated, I've translated the dwelling of Islam, or the territory of Islam, or the house of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, the dwelling of conflict. And Islam's mission is to bring the non-Muslim world into submission to Allah, either by conversion or by armed conflict. Now, a number of contemporary commentators have observed that the new Islamic resurgence, what the sociologist Peter Berger calls furious religion, shares many features with other recent Western utopianisms. The radical movements can be likened to both communism and liberal democracy as ideologies that attempt to remake the world. Communism is a radical version of the modern view of human progress, itself a mutation of Christian hope for the future. No Christianity, no communism, no Marxism. Marx saw history as a moral drama whose last act is salvation. Liberal democracy has been portrayed as the triumph of the slave over the master, representing the victory of the ordinary person, that is to say, the underdog in history, in the struggle for recognition. And both believe that their respective societies represent the highest and most progressive achievements of the human spirit. Islam, on the other hand, denies that either of these two developments is benign, or that present secular social forces will ultimately deliver a better world. It interprets Christianity's present weakness in the West as due to its failure to implement God's laws in all human affairs. Therefore, it sees itself as the one true answer to the moral confusion and social disintegration of former Christian lands. However, the Islamic thesis finds itself in a great dilemma. Manifest destiny, manifest success. Over the last 300 years, the West has been the dominant civilization, and Islamic civilization has been in decline. Whereas, for example, Islamic science once promised so much, in the end, modern science was born in Christian lands. Whereas once Islam ruled the seas and dominated trade, in recent times, the West has led economic growth, capital accumulation, and prosperity. The religion which should have promoted success has known consistent failure. And in Islamic theology, failure is a sign of God's displeasure and judgment. Much of the Islamic world has fallen into decadent ways by forgetting God and following the West. It has compromised its heritage, and it will only recover its former glory by repudiating Western ideals and returning to strict Islamic disciplines. Now, the one exception in recent years to the catalogue of failures has been the ejection of the Soviet army from Afghanistan in the 1980s. This, it is pointed out, was fought as a religious war, a jihad. Muslims from a wide range of countries were involved in the fighting, and here was a signal victory against one representative, as they see it, of godless European civilization. Refugees from the fighting in Afghanistan became more radicalized in the Islamic schools of northeast Pakistan, the madrasas, which certainly teach a version of civilizations in conflict. The ultimate outcome of the jihadist struggle in Islam was the Taliban regime, the most extreme form of Islamic rule seen in modern times. The Taliban rule is the most zealous form of belief that made it a top priority to cleanse the state from all pollution of the infidel. According to some, violence as a handmaid for the remaking of society is the chief motive for terrorist acts. Meanwhile, a common view in the West is that the rejection of Christianity's public role in the state was due not as Islam interprets it, but rather to a too successful integration of faith and politics, the so-called union of throne and altar. In this context, radical Islam is interpreted as a new version of medieval Christianity. And the present mood in the West, I guess, is to be highly suspicious of any alleged attempt by any religion or ideology to impose its views on public life. This, I think, shows why some of the tensions are around today. Let me go on to the final part, Islam, the West, and Christian faith. Given the reality of a world seemingly divided between two irreconcilable ideals, an Islamic or a secular state, religious control or a separation of powers, does the Christian faith have its own specific viewpoint to contribute to the discussion? One of the most significant ways of determining the true nature of a religious movement is to examine the circumstances of its birth. So briefly, we will attempt to describe the most salient features of both Christianity and Islam in this respect. The convictions of each, relevant to the role they should play in the public arena, may be deduced from their beginnings. Of course, I will have to be highly selective, and some of you may accuse me of being over-selective or selective in the wrong direction, but I'll do my best. So what about the origins? Firstly, of Christianity. This is a very, very potted history in a few paragraphs. A few weeks after the public execution of Jesus of Nazareth by crucifixion, a small group of Jews began meeting together in Jerusalem. They claimed that he was, despite the circumstances of his death, the Messiah, who had been spoken about in the Hebrew Scriptures as servant of God and Son of Man. In spite of persecution for their beliefs, for many were imprisoned for refusing to keep silent, the group grew rapidly in numbers, and new ones appeared as far away as Damascus and Antioch. After a time, Gentiles also joined them, and the movement spread to Cyprus, Asia Minor, North Africa, and eventually across the Bosphorus. For a time at least, they shared their belongings and met principally in each other's homes. They had a deep sense of belonging together, so much so that when there was a famine in Judea, groups sharing the same faith sent aid from the Greek provinces of Macedonia and Achaia. The communities were quite often caught up in disturbances. However, these appeared to be caused by people who found their teaching threatening. They were further oppressed for refusing to offer worship to the emperor. Despite major persecutions by Nero, Domitian, and later Diocletian, they resolutely refused to join in the imperial cult. And as a result, ironically, they were declared to be atheists. They also refused to enlist in the armed forces. By the year 70 AD, when the army under Titus, the Roman army under Titus, captured Jerusalem, they had become completely separated from the Jews and refused to join in defending the city or in any way being involved in the national war against Roman occupation. For approximately 280 years, that is to say from 30 AD to 310 AD, they survived as a persecuted minority, sometimes allowed to exist in peace, but often harassed. They had no distinctive places of worship. They continued to grow as people accepted their invitation to believe. There was no coercion, no compulsion. They did not exercise political power. Their reverence for life marked them out as a highly distinctive community. How did the Christians see themselves in the early years? They identified themselves as communities of people who believed that Jesus was the Messiah, the universal Savior, and that he was alive. They believed that they had been commissioned to take this message to all people, to invite them to become members of the community that represented God's new creation, and to teach them how to live as followers of Jesus. They were to live at peace with all people and submit to the ruling authorities unless required to engage in idolatrous or immoral practices. They saw themselves as a third race, whose primary allegiance was not to family or ethnic group, but to the multiracial community of the Kingdom of God. The question of exercising political power did not arise before Constantine, as the converts were largely from humble backgrounds. Their response to persecution was to bless and forgive the persecutors, not seek vengeance. They saw their calling to be a model of new life under the rule of Jesus Christ. So much for the early history of the church. What about Islam? In the year 610 AD, a man of 40, a member of the Quraysh tribe in the city of Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula, claimed to have received through the angel Gabriel messages from Allah, which is the name of the one high God. Allah simply means the God. The initial message spoke about the existence of only one God, God's hatred of idolatry, a call to care for the poor in Mecca, and the reality of punishment for those who did not believe. His preaching received a mixed response. Some believed he was a true messenger from God. Others, particularly the wealthy in Mecca, opposed him. In 615, some of his followers took refuge from persecution across the Red Sea in the Christian kingdom of Ethiopia. In 619, his wife, Khadijah, and his uncle, Abu Talib, both died. They were influential figures in the Meccan clan-based society who had protected Muhammad against threats to his life. But a new clan leader arose who withdrew all support from him. So in 622, that is to say 12 years after beginning to receive the revelations, Muhammad and his followers emigrated to a city to the north of Mecca at the invitation of the people there to be their leader and establish the unity of the city, say one God, one people. And this migration is known as the Hijra. The city became known as Medina al-Nabi, the city of the Prophet, today Medina. Muhammad became the governor. He built there the first mosque and produced a written constitution and law code for the inhabitants. In order to survive, Muhammad sent out raiding parties to take goods from caravans, a lot of trading going on in Arabia, from the caravans that were passing close to the city. This was quite a custom in those days. In one such raid, however, the party broke a sacred Arab convention that during certain months the caravans were to be free from assault. However, a new revelation from Shura 2:217-218 justified the attack in these words. This is really fairly significant. They question you with regard to warfare in the sacred month. Persecution is worse than killing, and they will not cease from fighting against you till they have made you renegades from your religion, if they can. But those who believe and those who emigrate and strive in the way of Allah, these have hope of Allah's mercy. And with these words, not just according to me, but according to many scholars, jihad or armed struggle was legitimated. Medina eventually resisted the hostility of the Meccans. In the course of the resistance, some 700 Jewish men were slaughtered for alleged treachery. Eventually, Muhammad returned to Mecca and captured it. In the year 632, he was then 62, 20 years after the initial revelations, 22 years after the initial revelations, 10 years after the emigration, Muhammad died. Now, the Muslim calendar is dated from the first year of the Hijra, that is to say, 6 2:2 AD, considered by Muslims as a central event of world history. And this is very, very significant. Initially, Muhammad saw that his task was to stop intertribal conflict, unite the tribes, care for the poor and needy, abandon a life dedicated to luxury and pleasure, preach the existence of the one true God, and the folly of idolatry. After the Hijra, Muhammad took over the running of a city. He became a lawgiver, dispenser of justice, and army commander. As Akbar Ahmed, a Muslim scholar, says, the ideal Muslim is the Prophet himself, leading the prayer in the mosque, the army in the battlefield, the council of elders as they discussed matters of state. My final heading, present realities. Ever since the Hijra of the Prophet and the early converts to Islam, Islam has been committed to and reliant upon a marriage with political power. However, for 12 years, 610 to 622, Islam was the religion of a group of people persuaded to believe in Allah and his messenger by the intrinsic power of the message, without any other consideration. In the light of this beginning, one may perhaps be allowed a fundamental question. To what extent should the situation in Mecca have priority in determining the essence of Islam? Of course, I nor any of us can answer that question, only Muslims can answer it. The question raises the issue of how Muslims handle the reading of their sacred scripture. Is it possible that parts of the Quran can be considered to be no longer literally applicable because the circumstances of the revelation have changed completely? It is difficult, for example, to suggest that Muslims are being persecuted for their faith today. The argument that only Islamic rule can properly ensure and safeguard Islamic faith is difficult to maintain when one third of all Muslims live in non-Islamic states. Moreover, such an arrangement would surely be a sign of the weakness and poverty of a faith that had to be supported by political institutions. As Kenneth Cragg, another world authority on Islam, says, Kenneth Cragg is 94, I think, and still writing. That gives hope for all of us. Islam is truer as a religion, he says, when it was tested by verbal contradiction in Mecca than when sanctioned in Medina against sedition. Now, I might contrast Muhammad's exodus from Mecca with Paul's reaction when people refused his message in Damascus, Pisidian Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Philippi, and so on. It is true that on occasion Paul defends himself by appealing to his Roman citizenship, but he never considers the possibility of using force to defend or promote the message of the gospel. The strength of prophecy in the Bible lies in the fact that the prophets did not belong to the corridors of power. In this sense, from a biblical perspective, Islam has a distorted view of what it means to be a prophet. In the biblical tradition, the prophet is not, by definition, either a statesman or a military commander. Cragg points out the high percentage of Muslims who live outside Islamic states. He points out that their migration is exactly the opposite to the one ordered by Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. That is to say, it is from a protected situation in Islamic lands to an unprotected status in non-Islamic lands, one third of all Muslims. They live, therefore, so he argues, as Meccan Muslims, as Muslims lived in Mecca, as a minority. But they are not being persecuted, at least We don't feel they're being persecuted. Some of them may feel they are. They practice their religion without recourse to political power. Why then, he asks, is it not possible to realize the ideals of Islam in a non-Muslim society without having to convert it first into an Islamic republic? Lamin Sane, who is a West African scholar who grew up a Muslim and became a Christian, argues that the state sponsorship of religion confirms secular suspicions that religious belief is too weak to stand alone. It appears to show a fear of criticism, of equal rights under the law, and of heresy. If the state must procure the allegiance of believers, the truth claims of religion have no intrinsic or persuasive merit. And in his phrase, it says, threats corrupt, and absolute threats make absolute hypocrites. And he goes on to argue, this is an interesting argument which we might perhaps tease out, that salvation by God's grace alone, through faith alone, is not only a true response to God, but also the foundation for social tolerance and democratic renewal, what the philosopher Karl Popper called an open society. So here he recognizes the political repercussions of Christian evangelism. The state has no right to interfere in the personal faith convictions of the individual. Faith cannot be coerced by outside agents. Freedom of belief is the most important lasting legacy of secular society. One final point. The current dispute between sectors of Islam and Western secular culture highlights afresh a profound conflict of perspectives. That, I think, for the sake of the integrity of the respective religions, has to be played out. So I believe Christianity is actually being offered a new opportunity to state afresh its own message concerning the relationship between faith and public power. If Christianity allows itself to be neutralized by secularism, it is finished as a community with a prophetic message of judgment, grace, and hope. Meanwhile, secular society, left to its own devices, is likely slowly to eat its own tail and gradually drift into either anarchy or authoritarianism. Christian faith represents, therefore, a different approach to present conflicts between civilizations from either Islam or the West as presently conceived. Christians have to be careful, therefore, not to be co-opted by either side in the current secular religious divide. I will finish there. I'm sorry, I've gone probably way over time. And I said earlier, it's a huge subject and I haven't begun to do justice to it. But there is time, I think. Obviously, if some of you have to go early, then that's perfectly understandable. But I do hope that it may have raise some questions or some comments, some observations in your mind so that we can have a good discussion.
I wonder if you could comment on the role of Abraham in Muslim and Christian history. From what I've read, he seems to have had significant influence in Muslim as well as Christian.
Yes, thank you very much. Well, Judaism, Christianity and Islam are called the three Abrahamic faiths because all of them in different ways trace their origins back to Abraham and to the creation of the people of God. However, the one radical difference is that whereas the Jewish people in particular, and I suppose Christians as part of that history also, trace their origin back to Abraham through Isaac, whereas Muslims trace it back through Ishmael. that is to say, Ishmael, who was the son of the slave Hagar. This perhaps is partly to emphasize their own tradition, their own ethnicity as Arabs, over against the Jewish people, who they came to see, particularly in Medina, as traitors. They believe traitors to God and to God's revelation. So although, yes, there are traditions going back to Abraham, there's even a tradition in Islam of the sacrifice of Isaac, except that it wasn't the sacrifice of Isaac, but the sacrifice of somebody else. These traditions are there as well. And perhaps most importantly for Islam, the very, very holy place in the center of the mosque in Mecca, the Kaaba, the black stone, which you will have seen pictures of, is associated with Abraham and with Hagar and Ishmael, that they were said to have resided there or stopped there on one of their journeys. Is that... Well, I think, yes, I mean, I think it can be a beginning, but I think the three traditions do also diverge quite seriously about how then they appropriate, if you like, the story of Abraham. And the way in which the New Testament appropriates Abraham, for example, Paul in Romans or in Galatians, is quite distinct from the way in which Jewish people appropriate him. So there is a tradition there, but there's also some considerable differences, which I think have to be recognized.
Andrew, your conclusion is one that I thoroughly agree with, but you did effectively say that Christianity faces a great challenge. And I do hope we can all rise to that challenge. But a question I would like to ask is that in Islam, and particularly amongst Muslim scholars, is the West, in quotes, seen as a Christian society or a religious society or as a secular society?
It's a very, very good question, yes. By and large, I think, probably more particularly for people outside, Muslims living outside Europe, the West is identified with the Christian faith without a shadow of doubt, partly because Islam finds it extremely difficult to divide society, culture and so on off from religion and say that it is possible. And one has to acknowledge that Europe, in our terms, is an exceptional case. They say all societies, right through human history, religion has always been at the center of the culture, of the civilization. Europe seems to be now an exception for the last, say, 200 years. And Muslims find it very, very difficult to accept that. Moreover, many of them see the secularism of the West as the fault of Christianity caused by the Christian faith, because we have allowed a separation between faith and social political life. And they quote at us, completely out of context, I have to say, render to Caesar as it were, and Christianity has had very little influence on it. So this is the way they see it. However, if you talk to Muslims who've lived in the West for a long time, as I have, for example, over a number of years in Birmingham, they do recognize that Christianity cannot be necessarily faulted for everything that goes on in the Western world. And moreover, they look to the Christian faith. Hence, Muslims
in places like Birmingham are very keen to send their children to church schools. They look to the Christian faith to help them in how to deal with a secular society. I'm not sure that we have the answers, but you know, they do acknowledge that maybe we have something which they can learn from. But yeah, that kind of separation has been made in Islamic thinking.
Come back if you want to come back. And if you have a subsequent question, that's fine.
Andrew, can I just ask you whether you would parallel Constantine's making Christianity the religion of the West and Mohammedan Medina?
Yes, to some extent, I think. There is a similarity in that Christianity became the official religion, if you like, of the Roman Empire, under this sign we conquer and so on, was given official status. And soon the church took on a very political role, and we know the history, the subsequent history, and that and so on. The two major differences is, one, Muhammad was both the ruler and the commander and the receiver of revelation, the prophet, which Constantine clearly was not. Constantine was the political figure. He was the emperor. And he had to win win Rome back, as it were. Also, one has to say that the Christian church managed, certainly as a persecuted minority in the Roman Empire, for those 280 years, without any semblance of political power whatsoever. Now, I think the difference today is that you will not find a Muslim anywhere, or very, very rarely, there are some beginning to think along these lines, who say that we want to go back behind Medina to Mecca and to look again at our faith in the light of the Mecca experience rather than the Medina experience, which is where politics and faith became intermingled. Whereas most Christians today think that Constantine was a disaster. We're quite happy to get rid of the notion of Christendom. And we have those 300 years, and we have the New Testament, as it were, to help us in rediscovering a faith which is not tied into political power. So I think there are similarities, but maybe, say, medieval Christianity became very like what Islam became, so that almost they were a mirror image of each other, you know, in the struggle between the two of them. Fortunately, we now live in a different kind of world.
Andrew, thank you very much. It's a very, very interesting talk. It's very interesting that you've managed to talk of Christianity and Islam as entities, very well integrated entities. In fact, from my perspective, I find that Islam is in conflict with itself, it seems to me, hence the problems in Iraq, and Christianity is exactly the same in the Western world, and democracy, it seems to be the enemy of both. Now, we've got a tremendous amount of irreconcilable forces operating that make dealing with these situations almost impossible if you could deal with them at all. Do you have any comments to make on my observations, and can you put me right if I'm wrong? Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with what you say. First, in the case of Islam, clearly the
vast majority of the violence in Iraq is Sunni and Shia Muslims killing one another, which is very tragic. And there has been this major division from a very, very early period in Islam's history, after the so-called the first four caliphates, or the first four caliphs after the death of Muhammad. So within 40 years or more after the death of Muhammad, Islam was split into two major groups. Then, of course, there are many other different what you call them, communities.
Andrew, sorry, can I just butt in, Andrew? There's a feedback thing that's happening when you do this. If you could try to stand as you're doing now, that's great. Sorry.
Stand up.
Is there anything on the left in the thing?
Stand up. Thank you. There are, you know, many others. And then there is a whole question in Islam of Sufism, the Sufi mystical aspect of Islam, which some people consider to be mainstream Islam and other people consider to be heretical. Within Christianity, all of us are only too well aware of the enormous divisions that have happened. We are too well aware also of the fact that Christians have fought one another over many years, been huge bloodshed, been persecution of Christians by Christians. We know this history ourselves. We are, we hope, thoroughly ashamed of it. All one can say, I suppose, is that there is no, absolutely no justification for either the division or the conflict between different branches of the Christian faith within the foundation documents of the faith itself. Quite the contrary. Christ himself prays that all his followers may be one, may be united. So the history is there. There have been, in recent years, enormous strides, I think, in bringing Christians together. Huge agreements where there was disagreement before, there is now agreement on major issues of doctrine, of theology, if you like. The Pope is visiting the Patriarch of Constantinople at this moment. So there are attempts, but the history is not good, and the history of Islam is not good either. I suppose a secular person would say, well, maybe, a plague on all your houses. And there certainly is a very vociferous minority of people in the West today saying the problem with the world is religion. And the solution, therefore, is to get rid of religion. That, we would say, is very simplistic, but is certainly a view which is put.
Democracy, one of the problems. It needs secularism to flourish, doesn't it?
Yeah, I agree. This, to my mind, is the is the major positive aspect of a secular society. A secular society, in that sense, is a society which does not favour any particular religious belief. It is intentionally neutral towards all religious beliefs in that sense. So it is not coercive in terms of one religion over against another. I think that is right, because faith in itself cannot be coerced. If it's coerced, it ceases to be faith, almost by definition. Faith is a personal response of the whole of one's life to God, therefore it is very much part of the individual's own response, if you like. So a secular and pluralist society, a pluralist society is a society which
allows the free reign of religions, of faiths, of belief systems, as long as, of course, they are not subversive of the secular society. So we are tolerant, but how? This is the problem with a secular society. How does a secular society tolerate those who do not tolerate a secular society? This is one of the conundrums, if you like, of the situation. And this is part of our debate today with militant Islam in Britain. How do we deal with something which does not play by the rules of the secular game? And it may be the case of Christianity also in Britain at some future date, that we would say there are laws on the statute book which are against our conscience. We have to disobey them. We don't play by your rules, by your secular rules, and take the consequences. What I think now is fundamental to the Christian faith is that we do it in a non-violent fashion. That we have reassessed our faith, gone back to the sources, gone back to the first 300 years, and seen that actually Christianity arose as a non-violent faith.
Well, and I just feel that one of the problems with America and President Bush, he is sort of identified with proselytizing Christianity with his democracy. And this has led to a lot of confusion and a lot of misthought in some way.
Yes, is Christianity a political faith, or is it political in any sense? It's a very difficult. I think one needs to make some very careful distinctions here. Christianity is not political in the sense of demanding to shape political power, to exercise political power. That is why, perhaps, although this is very disputed, Christian political parties, like Christian democracy, for example, are somewhat questionable. Because once they get into power, the very term Christian democracy means that people would expect them then to exercise their power in a Christian kind of a way. And because political power is always somewhat compromised, then the danger is that the Christian faith also gets compromised at the same time. However, at the same time, as we were arguing and as Kenneth Cragg was arguing, Christianity is a prophetic religion. It has a prophetic streak. If you go back to the Old Testament prophets, they were certainly immersed in the political life of the times, Hezekiah or, you know, the kings and so on of the time. And they got thoroughly immersed, but they weren't in power. They were persecuted. But they had something political to say. That is to say, they had a message from God about politics, without themselves exercising the political power. So I think that, Christianity, as much as Islam, is about the whole of life. We say Jesus Christ is Lord. The Lordship of Christ means that the whole of life is related to Christ. So in that sense, there is nothing that falls outside. But it's a question of ends and means. How do we shape a society which we feel is closer to what God requires than the society we have? Some Christians will be called into political life, but they mustn't give the impression that theirs is the only political view. That would be very dangerous, and it's probably good, therefore, in a democracy, in a multi-party state, to have Christians in all the political parties, which is what we've got, I think, in Britain today. But there is an argument, there is a discussion going on as to whether there should be Christian political parties at the same time. So I think my answer to your question is both yes and no. We're not political in one sense, but in another sense, we can't avoid public life and speaking about, because this is God's world, and we don't want to give it up to evil, if you like. Does that, I don't know, come back if you want to. Oh, hold on.
Three more.
Andrew, thank you very much for a very good and very even-handed, I thought, discussion or lecture you've given us. Where does the future lie? You start off by using the word conflict, admittedly with a question mark, but where does the future lie? We've seen within the Christian church various branches at loggerheads with each other. I mean, I was brought up in Scotland, and in Glasgow you had the Catholics were a minority. They were considered to be a fifth column of some sort by the Protestants. Certainly in the Western Isles, there was no love lost at all between the Free Church of Scotland and the Catholics. But we are beginning to see the Christians uniting in some common belief, you know, not talking so much about the differences, talking about what they have in common. With Islam, it has a common background, as you say, a common root. It's difficult not to believe that Allah is also Jehovah to the Jews or God the Father to the Christians, because the way in which the whole thing is explained in the Old Testament or in the Quran. Where is the common ground which would enable Christians and Muslims to meet together, to recognize each other? All right, they say that Christ is a prophet. Well, do the Christians say that Muhammad was a prophet?
Yeah, that would need another couple of hours. It's a very good question. Well, clearly, I mean, in spite of what the Quran says about Christian belief, that we believe in three gods, which we don't, Christians, Jews, and Muslims are all monotheists, believe in one God, and only one God. Believe that the world is created, believe that human beings have been put here with a purpose, believe that we are accountable to God for our lives, for the way that we treat the world, for what we do with the world, believe that there will be a reckoning at the end of time, according to the way in which we have responded to God and responded to one another. All these things, which are very fundamental, if you like, we have in common. Whether Muhammad, it depends which Christians you ask, I think, whether they consider Muhammad to be a prophet. Certainly, there's a lot in common between the Quran and the Bible in terms of an understanding of who God is, in terms of righteousness, in terms of justice, in terms of concern for the poor, and so on, that kind of thing. More, I would say, perhaps between the Quran and the Old Testament than the New Testament. But there are also very fundamental disagreements, not least about who Jesus Christ is. For Muslims, Jesus Christ is highly revered, but as a prophet, as a good person, but as a human being, not as divine, not as the savior of the world. this is fundamental to the Christian faith. I mean, you could not accept the Quran's understanding of Christ and remain a Christian. The two just, you know, there's a fundamental contradiction at that point, which has to be further discussed, of course. And one may ask all kinds of reasons why this should be so. You know, what was it in the history of the time that Muhammad grew up? Maybe that, a lot of people will say, Christianity itself at that time was so distorted. You know, it was in such decline itself that what Muhammad came up against was something that perhaps, you know, many of us would not want to recognize either. And this was the Christianity that he saw and didn't like the look of very much. But so there are obviously great similarities, but there are also very fundamental differences. The Quran makes it absolutely plain that they don't believe that Jesus Christ died, was crucified. Now the reason for that is because that would be a sign of failure in Muslim thinking, in Muslim theology, if you like. God could not allow one of his prophets to be crucified, to die in this way. Whereas for the Christian faith, it is of the very essence of our understanding of God that the Son of God should die. So, you know, when we're talking about God, the similarities, but we're also talking about considerable differences in our understanding of God. The God of the Christians is the God who is visible in Jesus Christ. And the God of Muslims is the one who has revealed in the Quran and inspired Muhammad in his life's work. Does that make...
And I'm also well aware that one of the problems that Muslims have is with the Trinity, because they cannot understand how God could have gone to hell. Christ ascended into hell, and so did he rise again. They say it's inconceivable that their God could ever have gone to hell. I realize there are these problems, but to some extent, is it not just words? Because Christ himself, as far as I'm aware, in his lifetime, never said he was divine. Divinity, he referred to his Father, or to the God above, but not to, he never said he was divine himself, did he?
Well, that's a long. There is only one occasion, maybe, where explicitly he claims to be the Son of God in his trial. I think it's in Mark's account of the trial of Christ. But he claimed the prerogative of God, of the divine, in so many different ways that though it wasn't explicit, one could say it was implicit in the power to forgive sins, for example. Only God can forgive sins. So if you read closely enough, you're right. It's not so explicit, but it's implicit. It's in the text, if you like. It's in the authority which he claimed in his teaching and so on and so forth. One could give many, many instances of this. So I don't buy the idea that, some people say Jesus preached the kingdom of God or the fatherhood of God, and Paul came along and preached the divinity of Christ. I think that's very simplistic view of the New Testament, because I think it's there in the Gospels as well as in the rest of the New Testament.